On this edition for Saturday, July 18th, the coronavirus outbreak continues to spread as the number of cases breaks daily records.
Now, so to all of the young people, to all of the children, we are getting in good trouble to set people free. We can do it. If we fail to do it, history will not be kind to us.
And remembering legendary civil rights leader John Lewis, next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. John Lewis, one of the leaders of the civil rights movement and a member of Congress for more than 33 years, died yesterday of pancreatic cancer. He was 80 years old. Lewis was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer last December, but continued to work, to vote in the House of Representatives, and to speak out as the Black Lives Matter movement protests began this spring. In early June, Lewis visited the newly named Black Lives Matter Plaza in Washington, D.C.
People in D.C. and around the nation are sending a mighty, powerful, and strong message to the rest of the world that we would get them.
In March, he traveled to the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, to attend the 55th anniversary of the voting rights protests in March there that became known as Bloody Sunday. In 1965, Lewis was severely injured on the bridge, along with many others, when state police attacked the peaceful demonstrators. He was beaten and arrested dozens of times at sit-ins, marches, and other nonviolent demonstrations demanding equal rights. Known for his powerful speeches, Lewis frequently reminded audiences that they needed to speak up and stand up for what is right.
When you see something that is not right, not fair, yeah, not just, yeah, say something, yeah, do something, get in trouble, good trouble, necessary trouble.
John Lewis was born on February 21, 1940, outside of Troy, Alabama, the son of sharecroppers. He attended segregated public schools and said it was the activism and the radio broadcasts of Martin Luther King Jr. that inspired him to dedicate his life to civil rights. Lewis left Alabama for college in Tennessee, where he helped organize sit-ins at segregated lunch counters in Nashville. In 1961, he was one of the original Freedom Riders who challenged segregation at interstate bus terminals across the South. Lewis helped found the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and became a key ally of Martin Luther King Jr. At age 23, Lewis was the youngest speaker at the 1963 March on Washington, where King gave his I Have a Dream speech.
We are tired. We are tired of being beaten by policemen. We are tired of seeing our people locked up in jail over and over again. And then you holler, be patient. How long can we be patient? We want our freedom, and we want it now.
In an interview with NewsHour's Gwen Ifill in 2013, Lewis reflected on his words that day.
When you gave your speech that day, you were considered to be a radical. Everybody remembers the I Have a Dream speech as being this uplifting speech about togetherness and brotherhood, but yours was a little tougher.
I felt that we had to be tough. I had to deliver a speech that reflected the feeling, the views of the young people, and also the views and feeling of the people that was struggling in the Black Belt of Alabama, in Southwest Georgia, in the Delta of Mississippi.
Lewis was elected to the House of Representatives from the district that includes much of Atlanta in 1986, becoming only the second African-American to represent Georgia in Congress since Reconstruction. Lewis continued to stand up and cause the good trouble he advocated throughout his life.
We're calling on the leadership of the House to bring common sense gun control legislation to the House floor.
He led a sit-in on the floor of the House in 2016, demanding gun control legislation after the Pulse nightclub mass killing in Orlando, Florida. He chose not to attend the inaugurations of President George W. Bush and Donald Trump. In 2011, President Barack Obama awarded Lewis the nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Today, Mr. Obama paid tribute to Lewis, writing, "He loved this country so much that he risked his life and his blood so that it might live up to its promise. And through the decades, he not only gave all of himself to the cause of freedom and justice, but inspired generations that followed to try to live up to his example." For more reaction to John Lewis's death and his legacy, I spoke with special correspondent Charlene Hunter-Gault and University of Pennsylvania professor and historian Mary Frances Berry. First, thank you both for joining me. Charlene, I want to start with you. Given not only your place in the civil rights movement, but how long you've known John Lewis, what does this passing mean?
Well, you know, I said to friends of mine who've been texting me since the word of his passing came out that I hope I could get through this without crying. But what's amazing, and I think what keeps me from actually shedding too many tears, is that John had been preparing for this moment all of his life, especially all of his civil rights life. Because when they got ready to leave Washington, D.C. on that challenge to interstate segregation, they wrote their wills and said, "We may not make it back." So John has been prepared to transition, as we say, all of his life. He was so strong that even at that young age, he was so dedicated to the proposition of ending segregation and everything that it meant that he was prepared to die.
Professor Berry, when you look at the arc of John Lewis's life, it's remarkable how many places he shows up in history. I mean, over and over again, here's this figure that's consistently there.
For me, John Lewis was forever a presence in my life. I remember that all my whole life. I'm 82 now. Since my adult life, John Lewis has been a presence. I'm from Nashville, and it was Nashville where he went to American Baptist Seminary, and it's Nashville where he and Diane Nash and other people started the Nashville protests, and it's Nashville where my little brother, my youngest brother, who was 12 years old, heard on the radio them talking about it and ran out of school and took all of his classmates with him and ran down to sit in. So he was there. That American Baptist is relevant to all of our lives. Jim Lawson, who taught them about nonviolence right there in Nashville. And after that, even until the present, John Lewis from time to time pops up in things that I'm doing, he's doing. We encounter each other, see each other, even in recent years. He became the warrior whose reputation from getting hit over the head down there on the bridge and all the other things that he did could be relied upon in policy discussions to make the statement or give you the support that people would say, "Well, okay, if you got John Lewis on your side, I guess maybe we ought to talk about doing that." He was principled. He did what he thought he should do. But if he thought somebody else knew more than he did or had more experience than he did, he would listen prayerfully because he was a spiritual guy too. He was practical, but he was spiritual and he was courageous. And he was useful to the movement forever because just saying his name or getting his support could be crucial at important times.
I want to ask you both this question. Charlene, you first. In the context of what is happening in America today, the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, the protests after George Floyd, And given how John Lewis perceived this struggle as a lifelong one, put that in context for us.
He saw this as a holy crusade. The fight that John fought didn't end when the civil rights movement, and by the way, we had a president then who was a white segregationist, and he shocked even John when John and the rest of the civil rights movement's activities led to the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, and this white segregationist president stood there and said, on this day, with this bill becoming law, we shall overcome. Now, can you imagine that happening today? Maybe it'll happen later today, who knows? But I think what's important is that John knew that this was not an instantaneous thing, that voting rights was very important. It's important today because what we see that they fought against, voting rights, is now on the table, and there are efforts to limit many people, including people of color, from voting. So in a sense, that phrase, what goes around comes around, comes around. And so I think that the fact that so many young people today respect and honor John Lewis also need to be to know that what we need today is a coalition of the generations, younger people, older people, getting together to do the kinds of things that have been done all along that John thought and fought for was so necessary. The Freedom Rides were the first ones to get international attention. We have that today. But what we also need is what John and so many others did. Once they finished protesting, they went down to those communities and worked hard, face to face, and now with masks, I hope, getting people to register to vote. There's something, lessons learned from John Lewis's past that are every bit as relevant today. Make good trouble and keep on keeping on is what John, I think, might say today.
Well, I would like to add to that and to say something that's a little contrary, but I have a habit of being contrary. I'm well known for that. John, I think, would want the Black Lives Matter movement to be more focused. One of the things he loved about Martin Luther King is that Martin's mind would organize things and ideas and goals and what it is we're trying to do. He admired that sharpness. And then one of the things that he learned in a life in politics was that if you want something, you have to pick what you want and then figure out a strategy to get that. And I think he would find that he'd like the Black Lives Matter and did movement, because it's nonviolent and it's a protest movement. And we know that nonviolent protest is an essential ingredient of politics. He knew that. He lived by that. But he would also worry about whether the movement would accomplish anything, because he would be worried about the diffuse nature of it and whether it could persist and flow. And also, while he would urge people to vote, and certainly he did, and he was a politician, and he wanted them to vote for him and other people like him if he could, he believed that you have to do more than vote. You have to be involved in protest, you have to be involved in holding people accountable, that otherwise you're not going to get anything done. That was his history. He knew that as a matter of history, and he knew that as a matter of reality. So I think that if he were giving a message, you know, over and over again to the Black Lives Matter movement and to the people of this country who want change and who want justice, that's the message he would give.
And I just, even more recently, it was just a few years ago after the Pulse nightclub shootings that he had that sit-in in Congress. He wasn't done. I mean, It was just remarkable to think that even at his age, he was corralling members of Congress to organize and protest. What is the thing that you're going to remember about him most, Charlene?
Well, you know, John was undeterred by any obstacle. He just kept on keeping on because he believed, as Martin Luther King did, that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And he was prepared, willing, and able to walk that moral arc from all those places where he took the first blow for freedom as he got off a bus and got knocked down and got knocked unconscious, but he kept on walking. And I think that's his legacy. John is one of the pioneers in our struggle to make America be what it can be. And that is a place that he, John, and Martin Luther King and all of the rest of them said is a place where you will be judged not by the color of your skin, because remember, the movement was interracial and white people died for us just as black people did. So this country must follow this notion that, well, this principle that we must all be judged not by the color of our skins, but by the content of our character. That is the message I think that John is, I think he's sending it to me right now.
Well, and I certainly hope that the day will come when that will be true with all of us. And but I think what I remember about him, I remember a lot, but the main thing that sticks in my mind always is that he was principled. He never gave up on his principles. He found a way. He was like the Energizer Bunny. He just kept going and going and going. I see him just going and going and going and always sticking to his principles.
All right. Professor Mary Frances Berry and Charlene Hunter-Gault, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Yes.
For more on the life of John Lewis and his civil rights legacy, visit pbs.org/newshour. For a second day in a row, the U.S. has had more than 70,000 COVID-19 infections across the country yesterday. As cases rise in the majority of states, some officials are reimposing restrictions to prevent the spread. Florida announced more than 10,000 new infections today and 90 deaths. Testing has increased, but the percent of positive cases has also been rising, almost doubling on average over the last month. Some areas in hard-hit southern Florida are now under nighttime curfews. That includes the tourist destinations of Miami Beach, where officials have struggled to enforce social distancing and mask wearing among some visitors. In Texas, officials announced a fourth consecutive day of more than 10,000 confirmed new cases yesterday. In San Antonio, refrigerated trucks have been deployed next to hospitals as temporary morgues. Florida and Texas are among 18 states identified by the White House Coronavirus Task Force as being red zones, meaning they had more than 100 new cases per 100,000 people last week. That's according to an unpublicized document obtained by the Center for Public Integrity this week. In it were recommendations for the red zone states to close bars and gyms and ask residents to wear masks at all times. Globally, the number of confirmed coronavirus infections hit a record high yesterday, according to the World Health Organization. There are now more than 14 million confirmed cases and nearly 600,000 deaths, according to researchers at Johns Hopkins University. In South Africa, the country's 337,000 cases make up nearly half the total cases on the African continent. And as cases rise, it's on pace to become a top five country affected by the pandemic. Despite an early lockdown in March enforced by the army, the country has become a hotspot in the last month. In response, South Africa's president reimposed a nightly curfew and an alcohol ban earlier this week. In India, several cities were put under lockdown this weekend after the number of confirmed infections topped 1 million. India is only behind the United States and Brazil in confirmed cases. Health experts warn that numbers will continue to rise in India as testing increases, which will strain a health system that already is at or near capacity. A peak in coronavirus cases in India may not come for months. And in Iran, President Hassan Rouhani, citing an unpublished health ministry study, estimated that the coronavirus has infected 25 million Iranians. That number is exponentially higher than the ministry's official tally of 271,000 cases. Rouhani did not explain what the new estimate was based on and urged Iranians to take the virus seriously. Starting today, Iran reinstated restrictions on some public spaces like coffee shops, zoos, and pools. As we reflect on John Lewis's civil rights legacy amid the ongoing demonstrations in support of Black Lives Matter, author Mickey Kendall says it's also time for a moment of reckoning for modern-day feminism. Her book, Hood Feminism, Notes from the Women That a Movement Forgot, is a New York Times bestseller and addresses the issues surrounding black feminism. Christopher Booker has more.
Despite having written extensively about gender, intersectionality, and sexual assault, writer Mickey Kendall considers herself only an occasional feminist. In her most recent writing, the New York Times bestseller Hood Feminism, Kendall lays bare just how and why she at times struggles to find common cause with modern feminism.
Hood feminism is the feminism of the working class, of people who live in inner cities, rural communities, who absolutely have to make a way out of no way, regardless of jargon, you know, the banner buzzwords, and it's not that identity doesn't matter, it's that survival comes first. If you've never had to worry about hunger or homelessness or any of these other things, if you think of them as separate issues that affect those amorphous people over there, because your world is one in which you're focused on how to be a CEO, you're focused on how to get promoted, you're focused on how to be president, those are the needs you make feminism about. And it's not that those things couldn't theoretically be important, but it means then that you're alienating all of the other people who are saying, hey, over here, food stamps, clean water, safe housing, right? And so it becomes a thing where the people with the loudest mic are not necessarily the people with the greatest need.
How and why has this been absent from the modern conversation that surrounds feminism?
I think because for a lot of people, they don't have to think about it, right? We've created this narrative, colorblindness is what we call it, right? That's supposed to be the goal. Well, if we're ignoring race, cool, except race impacts literally everything in American society, right? And yeah, race is supposed to be a social construct, but it's a social construct with plenty of teeth. So then we get into this place where your race is a predictor of your class. And therefore, if you are not below the poverty line, near the poverty line, and if no one in your family, your immediate social circle is, you can really narrow your focus into what impacts you.
How has social media changed the way you are approaching this conversation or engaging in the conversation?
A lot of these conversations were happening in private. Now they're happening in public. They're happening on social media. And then because they're happening in a way where it's accessible, right? You know, I'm old enough to remember before the internet. And in 1992, I would not have been able to talk to a feminist in Egypt about their concerns in the way that I can now. I would not have been able to have a back and forth conversation with someone in India about feminism and women, girls' education and, you know, the fact that educated girls uplift an entire economy, regardless of where you are in the world, in a 2-second interaction. But now you can have that conversation 24 hours a day.
Given the dynamics of all of this, is it possible for mainstream feminism to expand the sphere of concern?
I absolutely think it's possible. I think it's necessary, actually. Because as the wealth gap grows, as income inequality and all of these other things are growing, we're hitting a situation where feminism is going to really want all of these communities to show up, to vote with them, to do all of these things. People are not altruistic enough to hope that supporting white women will eventually trickle down to women of color or communities of color. How feminist are we if we're not looking out for the people who build these institutions and sustain that wealth? You know, Lean In worked to make some people a CEO, but I think we've got, what, 30 women CEOs or something like that, maybe 300 in the entire country. That's not a number that helps. At some point, we have to talk about the fact that women are slightly more than half of the world's population. And in most places, are getting almost nowhere in terms of ongoing, sustainable equality. Not to say that there aren't places that are better than others, but we're doing this weird 2 steps forward, 1 step back dance with actual equality.
Finally tonight, flags are flying at half-staff today on all federal buildings to honor Representative John Lewis, who died yesterday, and the tributes continue to pour in. We'll have more on John Lewis's passing on tomorrow's program. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular's goal has been to provide wireless service that helps people communicate and connect. We offer a variety of no-contract plans, and our U.S.-based customer service team can help find one that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.